Welcome to The Endless Spiral, a podcast dedicated to unraveling the intricate threads of mental health, eating disorders, and body positivity. We'll explore the profound depths of the human mind while shedding light on the often turbulent journey towards well-being. So join me as I chat to experts in their chosen fields, as well as individuals with lived experiences. We'll explore the multifaceted nature of mental health, while also dismantling stigmas along the way. In this episode, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by senior dietitian and researcher in child and adolescent obesity, the ASOI communications lead, Niamh Arters. Niamh's drive and dedication is to educate about weight loss bias, stigma, and help people understand how obesity can affect individuals and families. Niamh tries to dispel some common myths while helping provide realistic views and develop more compassion and understanding in our society. Please don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening from, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Well, hello, Niamh. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on this podcast and chat to me today. Obviously, in the intro, I kind of just explained who you are, but obviously, we were just chatting beforehand. This is a little bit of a surreal episode for the two of us because I haven't seen you since you were a baby, and obviously you're not a baby anymore, and it's just weird just kind of sitting here doing this podcast. So it's great to see you, but it is a bit surreal. I presume it's the same for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was teenager Keith, maybe, that I have from memories.
Yeah, my yeah, that's right, actually. Yeah. Jesus, I've come a long way since then, and I'm obviously, as people are probably familiar with my story, the teenager Keith and the 20s Keith and the 30s Keith is far different to the 40s Keith. And so the other version of me that you wouldn't have got your baby, but your brother's got, or probably a completely different version of me now. So we'll talk about that later. We get out of the podcast. But anyway, look, as I mentioned in the your intro, you're a senior dietitian and researcher in the child and adolescent obesity, and it's the ASOI communications lead. And we will talk about that, exactly what that is as well. And your passion, Niamh, is childhood obesity treatment. So if I didn't really explain what your role and your passion is in the intro, exactly how you would like it, do you want to just kind of give people a bit of an intro into yourself and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really passionate and privileged to work as part of a multidisciplinary team in treating children and adolescents who are affected by obesity. And there's very limited services in Ireland. So for quite a while, I was the only dietitian in Ireland helping families affected by obesity. And a lot of my advocacy roles, which is voluntary as part of the Association for the Study of Obesity on the island of Ireland, the ASOI, a lot of my fire for doing such work like this, speaking out and talking and trying to help inform and develop understanding on obesity, is because of what the families have taught me and what those with the lived experience of obesity have really educated and provided me insight with, of how unfair and unjust it is to be experiencing these things in our world, in our day to day, and it really just needs to be called out and stopped. So a lot of the families, especially the children and teenagers, I'm really grateful that they do open up so much to me in the clinical room, that they feel that it's a safe space to tell me such instances, even though some of them are quite shocking, some are quite upsetting. And then this is what fuels my fire to try and do something about it, because a lot of them feel they can't speak about this stuff because they feel it is my fault, or they feel so shamed, blamed, embarrassed. They feel they have no voice. They feel like no one's going to listen to me if I say about this because everyone thinks it's my fault. Everyone thinks I just, you know, the common public health narrative, eat too much, don't exercise enough, which is not the case. I can say that with obesity, it's not a case of, you know, exercising more and eating less. That's not treatment. That's, you know, helpful maybe for all of us to understand about healthy eating and about having a healthy relationship with food, but not extremes one way or another. And physical activity is good for all of us, for our mental health, releasing those endorphins. But again, it's not treating specifically obesity. We need to look at this as a multidisciplinary team. And I couldn't help families in the way I do without the other marvelous members of this multidisciplinary team. And that really shows, you know, how complex, how many different factors are at play. There could be children who have obesity who may not be able to run as much or be able to move around as much as other children their age. And they're quite aware of that. They can be quite, you know, already feeling excluded or already feeling different. And then you've got someone or all these public health messages being thrown at them that they need to be moving more. That's not helpful. And it might be helpful at this point to just explain from a health perspective what we mean when we talk about obesity is the definition from the World Health Organization, which is that
I actually
obesity.
wrote that down exactly. I actually went on, sorry, I actually went on to their website and I wanted to get the definition because I had a feeling I had a feeling of what I think it was going to be. And I know you're going to say it out here and I'll let you go ahead of it. I actually copied and pasted it down word for word because not great. But anyway, you go ahead and I'll give you my opinion on it in a minute.
Okay, so the definition for obesity is an excess or abnormal accumulation of excess adipose tissue, which is fat tissue in the body, that negatively impairs health or poses a health risk. And that is what we focus on in healthcare. We focus on the health and quality of life of the individual. And you see, what happens is with obesity, when our it's an interplay between sometimes an individual's biology, genetics, and then also our environment. So there's so many different factors going on here. It's not a simple quick fix or a one thing, do this and then you'll be grand, it'll be gone overnight. Which unfortunately, a lot of the time when people don't understand obesity, that's what they think, or that might be the advice that sometimes people are given. And by everyone in society, everyone has opinions about obesity. I was on a plane recently, a 5-hour flight, going to present some research in the area of child and adolescent obesity. And the person beside me asked me what I work as. And when I told them, they, again, like most people, jumped to all these assumptions and you know, oh, it's because of this, and this is the causes, and these are the problems, and this is how it needs to be solved. And a lot of it is blaming the parents and, you know, feeding them too much and not educated and all these kind of things. And I was like, I've got 5 hours here and he ain't going to be able to go anywhere because we're on a flight. So I'm going to use the next 5 hours very wisely. And by the end of the flight, he actually corrected himself in his language
Okay.
to use person first language. So he went to say an obese child and then he stopped himself and said, oh no, sorry, it's a child with obesity. Is that right? And I was like, yes, there we
Yeah.
go. One step at a time, or one, you know, little by little, getting that messaging out. So
Yeah.
that's one random person who hadn't, you know, thought he knew it all. And
Because as
now,
we were
hopefully.
saying, excuse me, because as we were saying earlier, it's like the obesity is describing the disease, it's not describing the person themselves, which is
Exactly,
exactly, I think
exactly.
it's kind of important to clarify as well, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. So, like, we don't say when we look at other diseases or health conditions, for example, cancer or heart disease, we don't say a cancerous person or a heart diseased child. Like that's
Yeah.
not, you know, we just don't do that.
Yeah.
Sounds strange. Why do we use the word obese so much? Why is that okay? Why is that acceptable in society to call someone obese? Because it's used, I noticed in the children, the teenagers telling me in clinic, it's used in a negative way. Being called obese is a tease, it's a slag, it's a form of bullying. But unfortunately, this is something that I'd really like to see happening, is that in school policies, weight, you know, bullying or teasing someone based on their body shape or size is the last acceptable form of discrimination in our society. In school policies, it's not there. There's, you know, policies or there's rules and regulations around bullying someone based on their race or based on their religion, lots of other conditions, but body shape and size is not
Oh.
widely recognized as an issue. And that's a real problem because then
Yeah.
it's acceptable to do it. It needs to be called out and it needs to be taught from a very young age that it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable to comment on someone else's body shape and size. And a lot of it is generational as well.
100%. It definitely is. I think, like we were just saying, like a while ago, where some people find the word obesity triggering, and that's exactly as you said, because it can be used in a societal negative way. But obviously, when you use it, you're using it in a kind of a clinical medical sense, because it's a disease. It's not a description of the person. It's a description, or it's the name of the disease. But the fact that it's
Exactly.
used in a negative way in society, and like, look, as people have always hear me talking about for so many, for so often, I mean, I've never experienced obesity, obviously, but I obviously live with body dysmorphia, and I think the self-stigmatizing you can do is crippling as it is without someone else, using a derogatory term as well to describe. Luckily I never had anything like that, but I think the fact that, and as you said about, you don't say to someone a cancerous person, or I think the fact that maybe some diseases aren't visual, they don't get used in a negative way, but because some people, they might already feel self-stigmatized, and they're already feeling that their disease is visual anyway, that the people can think, well, I can use this term to describe them when you shouldn't really. Am I making any sense? Do you know what I mean? I think maybe, yeah.
I do think though we need to separate obesity. In terms of we focus in healthcare on when there's an increased number of fat cells or adipose tissue, or the fat cells or adipose tissue is acting in an abnormal way. So it's not functioning as it needs to be. And what happens is these fat cells are infiltrating other organs. Like obesity can actually affect every organ and system in the body. So then you've got all these other consequences of the obesity. In addition to the mental health impact, and especially as time goes on, if the obesity is not addressed, if help and support is not received by trained health professionals who are knowledgeable in this area and aren't going to say more harming things like, oh, should just eat less and move more, it needs to be treated in an appropriate, respectful manner. But if it's not, and if there's a delay in getting that help and receiving that support, unfortunately, the consequences can add up. And you're going into this endless spiral. You've got way more complications to treat and try and manage. And I always go back to that impact on that child and that or that teenager and that family who are watching painfully their child and their teenager struggle and go through this. Some of them, like many of the adolescents with obesity, they don't want to go to school anymore because they're being bullied, they feel different, they're being treated because they're different, even by teachers. There's actually horrific studies done by Rebecca Poole in America, looking at teachers' subconscious bias towards pupils who live in larger bodies. And so this is a bit of a difference now when I'm talking about larger bodies, not necessarily maybe obesity, but the teachers rated their pupils in larger bodies as not being as motivated and not being as able to attain high education and to achieve as much in their education, which is based on nothing, just these preconceived attitudes, that's no facts. There's no facts behind that. And a lot of it is this subconscious stuff that's so damaging that we really need. So it's in like it's teachers, it's coaches thinking, oh, I need to just help that child. The child just needs a bit of a pep talk. Or a bit of a motivational speaker and to get them to, whatever. But actually, they've no idea what that child is going through. They've no idea that the reason the child isn't doing the walk a mile to school or those initiatives that they have, the reason the child isn't doing it is because they physically can't. They're struggling, they're out of breath. Their heart is pacing. Maybe it's a mobility issue. Maybe they're in pain. Like again, with obesity, there's a lot of musculoskeletal pain, which is where our physiotherapists come in to help with that. So maybe it's not like you have to walk before you can run. Maybe they've got a lot of pain walking. Maybe they've got really agonizing pain in their joints and their knees and their back from all this excess adipose tissue or these fat cells in all these other places and organs where they shouldn't be. We have to address that. We also have like children and teenagers who are denied treatments for other medical conditions, such as skin. So that's how obesity can even affect the skin, because a lot of drugs and medications are metabolized in the liver. And if there's fat, excess fat, or dysfunctional fat cells in the liver, it's going to affect the metabolism of drugs or medications. So a child can be not able to get medications or drugs for another completely non-related obesity condition because of the obesity. And then that can cause a multitude of effects too, because if they've got, for example, in the skin conditions, they may not be able to sleep very well at night. Lack of sleep can affect our appetite, can affect our energy levels, can affect our mood. Knock on effect, downward spiral or endless spiral.
Yeah. I mean, even listening to you speak sounds overwhelming. Can you imagine having to go through that as a parent and a child? It's overwhelming just trying to process all that information that you're saying, can let alone actually trying to go through it. But
It's
there's
really tough.
one, it's I'm sure it is, but there's one thing you mentioned at the very beginning I want to kind of reiterate, because it was something that I kind of learned, and I probably should have thought about it myself, but I didn't. Is the genetics thing, is that obviously, it's, well, I'm just using it from my pers or my perspective, my life story, that the body dysmorphia, I was very self-conscious of, I thought I had this body shape or certain parts of my body or whatever. And it was only kind of when I started to educate myself more on it, I realized that it's actually genetics. And I think that's another thing with your obesity, is that, as you said, it's a lot of it, or maybe all of it, I don't know, like you tell me, like it's genetics, a lot of it is genetics, and it's not the person's fault, but they don't necessarily think that, is it, or something like that?
Yeah, so thank you for bringing this up, because this is something that I wanted to try and go back to explain. When we're talking about obesity, we're not categorizing someone or labeling someone who just lives in a bigger body. There are many people who live in bigger bodies who are completely healthy, have no health issues, they don't have obesity. Obesity is when there is an excess or abnormal level of those fat cells. So the fat cells are starting to affect their health. They're not functioning. That adipose tissue is not functioning as biologically it needs to be. And this can happen for many different reasons, but it's not, as I said, there's many people who will live in bigger bodies, and that is their genetic potential, because up to like 70% of our body weight is actually controlled by our genetics. We're not in control of it, which is mostly not appreciated in society. Society feels, oh, well, now your one is losing the run of herself. Did you see her now? See her, after she hasn't lost the baby weight yet. These kind of comments, oh, that just has to stop. That's not appropriate. It's
I know.
not like, how is that okay to be passing these kind of comments? And I've noticed that a lot of it's generation to generation. So this is why it has to
100%.
stop. This is why we need to be having these conversations. To stop it going, stop it continuing. That's not okay to be commenting on other people's body shapes and sizes. We don't do it with skin. We know that. And we've learned that, I think, as well, over time. We've learned that that's not okay to say certain things because that's just the way they are. And there's nothing wrong with having white skin or black skin or whatever color.
I think when people maybe, I'm obviously can't speak for everyone, I can't speak for anyone older than myself, but I think when you say about, that people don't comment on your skin or something, I think because people maybe, some people think that if someone is in a bigger body, it's their fault. Do you know what I
Definitely,
mean? So,
definitely.
like, yeah, where you wouldn't say to someone, comment on their skin or certain things, because you're like, well, that's their skin, it's not their fault.
Yeah, absolutely, Keith, because people don't understand that 70% of body weight is controlled by genetics, which is out of a person's control. It's nothing they could be doing, everything under the sun. And a lot of times they are, like, especially in when you get to the adulthood. And a lot of the time by then, so much damage has been caused along the way of yo-yo dieting, trying this diet didn't work for a while and then stopped. this diet worked for a while, then stopped trying this, trying something like forcing themselves to run until they're sick and absolutely hating it just because they feel they have to, because the magazines have their bikini bodies and all, like look at what we see around us. Ads on media, ads on TV, you know, and said the magazines over the years. This is what we've been like brainwashed with, I think, over time, is that, you know, this idea of the perfect body. Like I remember it was the perfect 10, you know, size 10, or this, all these ideas. Whereas actually, I hate the word perfect anyway. I run away from
Me
it.
too.
But the, you know, it's the best, or the happiest. I think the happiest body for you, when you're happy, when you're reaching your full potential. And that's where I suppose, you know, with obesity and healthcare, the children and teenagers aren't able to reach their full potential. So that's what we focus on. We focus on these other clinical outcomes. Can we help them to be able to get that medication for that other condition, that skin condition, so that then they're able to sleep better at night, and then they're able to maybe play sports, because at the moment they can't play sports because they can't get the medication, and their skin is, you know, they've whatever that skin condition might be driving them mad, like uncontrolled eczema or things like this. That's a massive help. And then suddenly the child is able to do these kind of things, or, you know, feels comfortable eating in front of their friends again. We've so many children, so many teenagers really that I see, because obviously the dietitian, that's a lot of my work is the food. And it's I don't ever mention the word diet, apart from saying I'm a dietitian, but then I'm like, just call me Neve, or call me whatever you want. Call me the food lady, call me the food doctor, whatever. Just like, no, diets, it just ends up sending them down again, this endless spiral.
Well, there's so
Have I
many.
thrown the name of your
You
podcast
mentioned it more than I do. I'll send you some merch. You'll be great. You're looking like a walking billboard.
Yeah. But it is. It's such, it's a brilliant name for talking about things like this, because it is such an endless spiral. And it's often caused by factors outside of one's control. It's caused by a lot of society around us, our environment around us. It's caused by our genetics that we can't do anything about. You know? And like with the genetics, you know, and our evolution, if we think, I'm going to borrow an analogy from Dr. Michael Crotty, who is the GP clinical lead for obesity in Ireland. And Michael Crotty, he explains it really well with the polar bears. So polar bears have evolved over time to survive in extreme cold, harsh conditions, periods of where they need to, you know, eat the fish when they can find it, because then they might have to go a long time without being able to find any food. If we were, that's the polar bear. The polar bear has adapted, it has evolved over time to survive in this environment. If we took the polar bear and put it into the desert, everything that its body, its biology, has developed over time to protect it in the harsher climates is going to go against it and probably end up killing it in a desert, because it's such a different environment. And I get challenged a lot, particularly by the older generations, who say things like, you know, when I'm trying to explain this and obesity and what it is and what it's not and what's helpful and messaging, and they go, yeah, but sure, like in my day now, we didn't have the same level of obesity. Sure, we didn't have, you know, it's, and I'm like, yeah, and did your work, did the environment that you live in look like it did now? Oh, no. Sure, we had three meals a day, and we were up with our oats and the brown bread in the morning, and blah, 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 blah. And we were out in the farm all day or whatever. And I'm like, exactly, Granda, you've nailed it. The environment is completely different now. We have to get real. We have to live in the times that we're in. Live in the present, live in the moment. You know, we can't keep comparing to, oh, well, years ago there wasn't the same levels and you didn't see it as much. But we don't live years, you don't live back, we don't live years ago now. Our lives are completely different. So we have to adapt. We have to adapt. And this is why some of us who are genetically predisposed to develop obesity, maybe years ago in the grandparents' days or whatever, when our environment looked very differently, maybe we wouldn't have developed obesity. But now we do, because it's an interplay. It's called epigenetics. So it's the interplay between our environment that we live in, our genetics, and then our biology.
So Right, so I'm gonna basically ask really simple questions because maybe just, well, because I'm really curious and I'm sure other people might have the same questions. So yeah, you mentioned people in bigger bodies, and then you mentioned obesity. So where's the line? What's the difference, or is there a difference?
Okay. Yeah. So with obesity, it's where their health and their quality of life is being negatively affected. And how we can diagnose that is by using clinical staging systems. So
Right.
in pediatrics, we measure growth, and growth in pediatrics is a vital sign of health. Now, I'm not just talking about a number on a scale. I'm talking about height as well as weight. And also, particularly in the older children and adolescents, we would look at bioelectrical impedance. So we're actually able to see the different body composition, how much of it is lean mass, because that's really, really important as
Right.
they're growing older. And that's something that's n often underlooked in society, really. And I think it would really help people's understanding, because with adults, we've stopped growing. We're not going to grow in height anymore. So the only number, is the body composition measures or weight. Whereas in children, we have to be able to help them reach their full growth potential, which includes their height, which includes their weight. So as a senior pediatric dietitian, I would see a lot of children who maybe have, especially when they're younger, they might have very limited acceptance of foods. So they have a certain number of foods that they might accept for different, could be different reasons, could be sensory, there's lots of different reasons why. Could be food insecurity as well, food poverty, which we see a lot of now because of the rising costs of food inflation and cost of living. And what can happen, this is why the growth charts and tracking along centiles is really important in pediatrics. The weight might keep increasing, but the height isn't. The height is not tracking along with the weight. And that's an issue that needs to be addressed, because otherwise the child isn't going to reach their full height potential. And what it can indicate is that the child is not getting enough protein, or there's not enough mixture of the different nutrients that we need, because it's not just one thing. We need a mixture of all these different nutrients. That's why variety when it comes to food is the spice of life. And that's why it's so important to try and have a healthy relationship with food throughout childhood, throughout adolescence, and as adults. But we're being warped and being receiving constant information, overwhelming about diets and this food and this food this week and that food that next week, and all this kind of nutribabble. It can get so muddled and get so confused, and especially with children, and particularly the teenagers who are really influenced by peers and are on social media a lot. So they're watching these ones on TikTok or whatever it is, and they're seeing them following this or eating this or doing that, and they think, oh, so that's what I have to do to be like them. And if they look successful and happy, or they look like they've got a whatever a good body to them might be, that's what I have to do that. And this is the like little seed, that can then, if it keeps going, it can develop into disordered eating, it can develop into, unfortunately, poor body image and low self-esteem, low confidence, and just a load of really sad complications
Well, you
mental health.
mentioned, yeah, and yeah, exactly, yeah, and that's exactly it. Well, you mentioned TikTok and social media there, and I'm just kind of going off topic here because it just kind of came to mind. But I spoke to the Irish Times recently because they reached out to me because they're doing an article on looks maxing, and I was like, never heard of the term before. Have you?
No,
No,
maxing
it's
surely.
yeah, I mean, I. When I explain it, you'll know what it is, but the actual term I'd never heard before. Been around for a while, and what it is like it's basically scoring your looks. So you just see on TikTok, you see someone with like a template and be dragging it across onto someone's face and their nose and their eyes and their chin. You score someone's face, and there's soft maxing, which is like moisturizers and creams and all that type of stuff, and then there's hard maxing, which is where the cosmetic surgery comes in. And it can just show you the negativity of social media when it comes to that stuff. I was just, when you were mentioning TikTok and social, I was just wondering, had you ever come across that with any families or any adolescents that had come into you? Well, obviously, maybe just in a different way, they just wouldn't use that term, I suppose.
Maybe like I'm so grateful to work with with children and young people because they do keep me down to earth. Like they, even in terms of lingo and stuff, but some of the stuff that they explain to me that happens on the social media is vicious and it's so toxic and it's not regulated. There's no way, and even parents sometimes aren't aware of it. Sometimes they tell me things when the parent maybe is out of the room. They tell me things in confidence, or more privately, and it's vicious. It's vicious and it's so scary because how do we control that? I think this is where a lot of the psychologists on our team, their work would come in and trying to build up that individual child's self-esteem, and their confidence, their value, their sense of self-worth, so that they to try and help them build more resilience against this kind of stuff that they're being constantly exposed to. Like what I do see a lot of is that the bullying now isn't just limited, leave stays in school. It follows them home. It's everywhere. Even if
Gross,
they're not going to
unfortunate.
school, it's on social media. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's so hard for them to escape it now.
And now it is. It's everywhere. And as I always say, it's on-demand content. So it's always like obviously when I was younger, when I was a teenager, there was no social media. So like you could kind of live in the little bubble to an extent if you wanted to. But as you said, it didn't follow you home. At least if you went home, you had some sort of safe space, if you want to call it that. But now, like they've got their phones, and their phones are buzzing, and it follows them home, and it's terrifying.
Absolutely, Keith. And I think it's really important to appreciate that it's not as easy as saying, oh, sure, just don't go on it. If it's bothering you that much, sure, just don't go on the social media. Because that is so much of their social life now. That is where a lot of them are hanging out and a lot of them are doing in their evening time. And if you aren't on it, then you're missing out.
Yeah, as you
Even
said,
if
the
you are on it.
environment as well, it's their environment.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I'm so grateful to I stay away from social media personally as much as I can. I recently learned that both my parents are on Instagram and I'm not. So I'm like, oh
Even
God.
I knew that.
Yeah, I was like, Dolly, what's that telling me? But I'm really grateful to work with children and teenagers because they really keep me down to earth and keep me up to date with the lingo. Like one of them said to me the other day, I don't vibe that. And I was like, sorry, you don't what now? And they're like, it's not my vibe. And I was like, oh my gosh, what do I vibe? Do I vibe? What do you vibe? What do you vibe?
Do I vibe? Fuck's sake.
They're
Holy fuck.
brilliant though.
Oh God.
I
I
love
swear
it.
you're 70.
I know. I literally feel like that sometimes. The worst is my dad or my mom come and say something like that to you. I'm like,
Yeah. You'll ask your dad, does he vibe?
do
Jesus.
you vibe that?
Oh God. Right, let's focus. Let's focus. I wanted to just before we move on to, I want to talk about obviously the parenting. I want to talk about your role and kind of what parents should do, when they're worried and all of that stuff. But before we get to that, I just want to go back quickly because I'm going to open up a can of worms here because this is something I guarantee that so many people are probably thinking in their head when you're describing the obesity and the bigger body stuff. Where does the BMI come into this? Because I know it comes into it somewhere, and I know it's such an absolute just minefield for everyone.
Yeah.
Go.
Okay. So when it comes to BMI, body mass index, and I purposely haven't mentioned numbers that much in this conversation at all, because I believe that so much of the discourse around obesity is focused on numbers, and I don't think it's helpful. So if I came on and I was like, oh, well, the rates of obesity are, or the prevalence is, and one in five, whatever, that's what people hear. And that's all they go away with. They just go away with these big numbers, these shock statistics. That's what all the media loves. If you ever look at the headlines around obesity, it's always like these shock statistics and scare factors, and that's not really helpful because that's all that people see. And it just then constantly keeps on going, and it actually drives then stigmatizing and derogatory attitudes and behaviors because people are like, oh, look at the numbers, they just keep going up. Sure, people are losing the run of themselves and can't control what they're eating and need to move more, blah 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 blah. So with BMI, the reason it's used is because it's a tool for measuring a large proportion of a population and getting an idea of very general idea of body size within a population. However, that's going to include people who are healthy, happy, living in bigger bodies, don't have obesity, don't need to come near healthcare, off with their lives, go enjoy, live it to the full. It also includes those like who are in sports and athletes who may have bigger bodies because of their because of maybe their that's helps them to be so good at their sport. So for example, our rugby players or like there's many examples. That's going to include them as well. And again, they don't have obesity. They're healthy, they're happy, they're like extremely maybe fit or in good condition. They don't have obesity. So this is where BMI at a clinical level is not useful for diagnosing obesity. In treatment and management services, we use staging systems. We use clinical staging systems where we're looking at the complications. We're looking at, well, is this a case of there's actually no issues here? The child is maybe just genetically determined to be at a higher height and higher body weight. And we look, this is where growth charts come in. And that's why I mentioned earlier on that growth is a really vital sign of health in pediatrics. And we measure growth from very young. So when babies are born, you know, we start looking at their centiles and we start looking at their tracking along centiles. And this is where, if in pediatrics, if there starts to become a large gap between the height and the weight centile, then that can cause, you know, that's a red flag. And normally this is done in the community. So it might be every time a child goes to their GP, just for general, maybe ear infection or snotty green boogery nose or whatever it is. They might use that opportunity, their GP, their general practitioner or family doctor, to just check their growth, check their height. It's not always done, which is often a limitation of time in general practice. But what I would really encourage parents to make it a part of just health. And that way, it's done in a medical setting. It's done in a respectful way. It's done by the doctor, just as the doctor might check your blood pressure or might use the cold stethoscope. I always remember the stethoscope would be freezing and they put it on your, you know, your back and listen to the chest or whatever. It's just a routine. Routine. It's just done. It's not made an issue of. You know, it's just done in a respectful, private manner. Check your weight, check your height, plot them on the centile charts. You need to plot them on centile charts. You can't eyeball. Can't look at a child and go, oh yes, look, they're grand, or they're a great eater, or they're a great feeder, they seem to be grand. Or they're wearing the clothes for their age or whatever. You have to, because everyone is so different and it's determined by our genetics, as we talk about so much. So we need to look at it along the centile charts. And nurses are another one that can do that in the community. So again, if there's any pediatric health checks, using that opportunity as parents or caregivers, that it's done in a respectful environment. And that's when it can be picked up earlier in a child's life and go, oh, jeepers, actually, hang on, the weight is 2 centiles above the height. That's a bit of a cause for concern here because it means that maybe the child isn't getting enough protein and then they're not going to be able to reach their full height potential. And the weight is going to keep on increasing, increasing, increasing. And you can't undo, like, I feel really privileged that I got to do a lot of voluntary work in Uganda in Africa. And I was working in extreme poverty. So no child looked their age. Like everyone, all of them were malnourished from the womb. So because their mother was malnourished as well during her pregnancy. So they, like, there was a, like a long, 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 long line of stunting. Where they're not reaching their full height potential, their weight as well, you know, as that no child looked their age over there. And that's really helped me, I think, apply that experience here in pediatrics, because I can see that actually the like growth is number one. I said it's such an important indicator for in children and teenagers. It can tell us so much information. And it's not, it's, you know, sometimes it's, well, maybe they're actually not getting enough of some things that they really need. Like, as I said, the protein, or it could be iron, or it could be calcium, or it could be whatever. And that needs to be addressed because that really is going to impact their health for the rest of their life. If they're not absorbing enough calcium into their bones and their teeth, that there's going to be at severe increased risk of things like osteoporosis in later life.
Yeah, it's the health risks as well.
Totally.
So you mentioned that the kind of the public health nurse can do things and your GP can check things. So let's kind of go back to kind of the beginning of the process here. So just say you're a parent and you have fears that maybe your child isn't meeting the growth charts, don't you call them?
Yeah, the centiles, the growth charts. But like parents probably wouldn't have a growth chart at home themselves. They can
Yeah.
ask for them, certainly. They can ask them in their
Well,
medical,
if say the
their
parent
health
has
check.
like concerns or worries that, what do they do first? Because like we were just chatting obviously before we started recording, and when it comes to kind of the healthcare system in Ireland or really anything really, the parents and anyone really can be so overwhelmed and not knowing where to start, and they feel a bit lost, and what do they do and where do they go? So what would be the first protocol, and how would people kind of parents get their child kind of moving on this kind of on the healthcare system?
Seeing if it is an issue, kind of be addressed, nip it in the bud, or maybe, that worry might just be put to rest. And actually, no, your child is growing fine. They're just going to be taller and they're going to be a bigger body. That's just the way they genetically are. What size is dad? What's, like I would often ask that in the clinical environment, is dad, what height is dad, or what's that dad's body shape and size like? Just to get an idea of what might be their genetic potential. And sometimes it's not just parents, it's the grandparents, aunties, uncles. We are a mixture of genes. There's so many genes that we have. That's why, like in big typical Irish family, none of us look the same. Or well, none of us are exactly the same. You might be able to tell most our siblings, but we that's why some people might look more like their cousin or that kind of thing. And I would say as well, Keith, just for any parents or caregivers who are listening and who have experienced negative encounters, either in healthcare or this constant feeling of being blamed and shamed, could be by other family members, could be in the community, could be a teacher in school or someone again who just passes a comment about their child's body size. And that can be really hard, that parents feel a lot of guilt. They may feel it's their fault. They may start trying to do things, but maybe in an inappropriate way. So they may start, I've heard some parents that would limit one child, but the rest of their children still get to have the whatever it is. And but the parent doesn't know what else to do. I understand from both sides, it's like, well, people are telling me and I'm worried about their body size and shape, but how what do I do about it? They're active, they're playing more sports than the others in their class, all this kind of thing. So we have to really come from it from a compassionate and understanding and respectful point of view. If you're worried, if you're concerned, try and have that conversation with the child's doctor. Could be a GP in the community. Maybe the child is already linked in with other health services. Could be a CDNT, so a community disability network team in the community, or could be a public health nurse, or they may be linked in with a pediatrician in a hospital. Could be hospitals around the country or one of the Children's Health Ireland hospitals in Dublin, and have the conversation and ask, say, explain, I'm a bit concerned. Could you please check their growth and plot them on the centile charts? And then we can see, okay, are they tracking along the centiles that they always have been in their life, and are they following their growth trajectory, which means that they're reaching their potential, or is there kind of gaps? Is one, is the weight starting to track along higher centiles while the height is tracking along lower centiles? This is where, okay, well, maybe actually we need to look at this a bit more, because if we can get it early, if we can see these things early, we're able to treat it earlier, we're able to intervene, and then we don't have as many complications down the line. And then that means that child again always goes back to that health and quality of life of the individual who's affected, so the child doesn't have to go through as much in their life or related to their health. If it can be, like early intervention is key. Prevention is obviously better than cure, and then it's early intervention, and then it's getting linked in with the appropriate health services. Childhoodobesity.ie is also an excellent resource for both health professionals and for parents and caregivers. So even if you're a teacher in a school and you're like, oh, this sounds probably quite applicable because I work with children and teenagers or whatever every day, and I've quite a big influence, or Maybe I need to educate myself a bit more. Maybe I need to inform myself, make sure I'm using the right language around this kind of thing. Childhood obesity, DALI, look at the resources. There's resources for health professionals, there's resources for families, and there's also, if you are a health professional, there is free online training at childhoodobesity.ie, and you can complete them in your own time, and they're CPD accredited. So you're going to get your continued professional development brownie points for doing them. And we're constantly updating the modules because there's a plethora of research constantly being conducted in obesity, which is brilliant. Brilliant. Because the more we know, the better informed we are, the better our practices and our options for treatment and understanding to help individuals affected to manage this. So it's brilliant that there's so much brilliant research and things like that going on. But yeah, childhoodobesity.ie for anyone, for everyone and anyone, no matter what background you're from. And then I'd also really recommend the Irish Coalition for People with Obesity. So it's the website is ICPOobesity.org. And this is a brilliant hub of individuals who are affected by obesity. I've learned so much from them. They share their experiences. There's parent groups. They provide support to one another. They do online support meetings. They speak out at so many events all around the world about their personal experiences. And I can't express how important that is and how valued it is because it's really hard. And I'm sure, Keith, you can appreciate this yourself, talking about something so personal like body dysmorphia. It's really hard to put yourself, in the public like that, in such a vulnerable place that you can't take it back, especially now, like media's, kept forever. It's always out there once it's out there.
I know, like the amount of times people will tag me in an interview that I'd done 2 years ago, and I'd be like, Jesus Christ, I forgot I even said that. You know what I mean? It does, like, I mean, and it is, you have to, I try and be careful as well, but it's, as you said, it is so hard because it's the self-stigmatizing that happens, or at least that used to happen. I don't do it so much anymore, but as you said, it's hard enough when you self-stigmatize without someone else doing it as well. But the website you said there about the resources, both of them, I think they're, it's really important as well to mention things like that, because even just talking to you today, it's the education around this stuff that most people probably wouldn't be aware of. Like, you've said so much stuff today that even I'm like, okay, I didn't even know that. You know, like, even the explaining certain things or the differences between what obesity is and what isn't and all that type of stuff. And I, because I, like I said, I'm a parent myself and I've got three small kids, and you can be a bit disillusioned sometimes or where to go, what to do. You hear waiting lists for some things are colossal. You said, I think you said at the very, very beginning, you either were or are the only dietitian that was dealing with this.
Yeah, so there are more teams coming down the line now,
Okay.
thanks to the HSE new model of care for overweight and obesity, which is brilliant. So we've got, as I said, more teams coming down the line, and they're going to be full multidisciplinary teams to be able to cater for all the different consequences that can happen in obesity. But for a long time, obesity was not addressed in and of itself as a disease. It was like, we'll focus on, the complications downstream that obesity causes. So it was like, we'll focus on the diabetes and the heart
Right.
disease and
Okay, I get you.
mental health. Whereas actually it's like, well, why would you not just stop the flow upstream and prevent things going downhill into that downward spiral? Do play a
I'm
game the amount of times I've mentioned it.
barring you from saying that from now on. Come up with a different analogy. Get your own.
But you know what I mean? Like it doesn't make sense to allow these things to happen and then treat them, but there's just such a lack of services. Like I appreciate that there's a lack of services and there's a lack of funding for so many things in our healthcare, but this is where my passions and where my fire is fueled to, to try and help and drive more supports, drive more understanding, and be enable families and individuals to be able to access the healthcare that they deserve, like under the United Nations Convention on the Rights of a Child, access to equal to equity and healthcare is a right. It's a basic right. And it doesn't exist in our country, in our, in this day and age, that doesn't exist.
I know, I know. And that's what I'm saying to you about knowledge and education, and even parents even knowing where to start. So what type of care would a child I'll actually, do you know what? I'm going to rephrase that for a second before we get to the child. When the parents bring a child in, what did the parents get any education? Did the parents get any help as well from yourselves?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. As like, look at, again, similar to most health conditions, there is no one size fits all. It's a really tailored approach. So when they first come to see us, and that's the hardest, that's one of the hardest things, is actually getting them to come for that first initial appointment to meet all of us as a multidisciplinary team, physiotherapists, the nurse, the pediatricians, the psychologist, the occupational therapist, dietitian, to
Wow, okay.
actually get them to come and meet us can be so hard because of the underpinning stigma and negative encounters that they've experienced up to this point.
Are you talking about the kids or the parents or both?
Both. Sometimes it's a battle trying to get the child or the teenager out the door. They don't want to come because they fear. They don't know. There's not so little information about what actually appropriate, respectful, evidence-based obesity treatment is. And there's way more noise and jargon around diet culture, and like, they might be comparing to the adult weight management groups in communities, such as the Weight Watchers, the Slimming World, the Slim Fast, all of these kind of ones. And parents might come with that perception of, oh, that's what this is going to be like for my child. Or maybe the child is watching their parent or their auntie or their whoever, their granny, going to these groups and going, I don't want to have to count points or, count my sins. Like, and like, that is absolutely like not what we do ever, ever. There's no counting. Like, that's something, I don't focus on numbers at all. Obviously growth important, but I'll always ask a child or teenager if they would like to do their growth measurements. They won't ever be forced. And if it's something that's particularly upsetting, in that consultation, well, then it's not the be all and end all, and I won't do growth measurements that day. It's not, I focus on what can I actually help them with now? What are they? And I ask them. It's so basic to ask, how can I help you? But sometimes, people are on their high horses and they jump in and they think, oh, I know how I'm going to fix this. Sometimes it's not about fixing.
I'm just going to
You don't
say
have
that,
to
yeah.
always have a solution to the problem. And even I see that a lot with parents, and I really try and show my empathy for parents, because parents, they feel like, oh gosh, I'm to blame, or they've received comments from other family members, like the very ones, the grandparents who would, in one day or one situation, they'd be like, I feed that child up now, that child needs to eat more, look at skin and bone, skin and bone. And then suddenly the same grandparent will turn around and be like, now you should really cut back now. You should sit, cut back and make them be working or exercising more. Like, it's so vicious,
Yeah,
so vicious.
I
And it just
know.
seems it's so acceptable, whereas actually it's no one's business. It's no one else's business what that person's going through, what that family or that child or whoever is going through. It's great if the family can share with us what they're going through, because then obviously we are able to tailor our approach and help. And see, well, which members of our team? Social work is another really, really important part of our team. And a lot of the social work side of things might be parenting support, like
So
that
that's what I
education.
was going to ask you that. So you mentioned the psychology earlier on, obviously that mainly for the child, but would the parents get any counseling at all?
And so both from psychology, and then there's also the social work would have a lot of support in the community that they might be able to, or just awareness of different services out
Okay.
there that they might be able to direct the parent to, or help the parent to link them in with. And like, it's not just, the it's not just families in a parent unit. We also have a lot of children who are in care. We also have a lot of
Right.
children,
Okay.
families who are in they've they're homeless. They're living out of hotels, or they're living in refugee centers or asylum seekers. And as a dietitian, can you imagine what it's like for me, like my advice to someone who doesn't have any control over the food that they're being provided with, or that their family is being provided with?
Good point.
They've no outdoor space. They're living in like one small room, and they're not allowed. They're not allowed maybe to cook due to, food safety concerns and issues. Imagine how limiting that is.
Good point. What age groups
come through your doors, or do you see?
From 2 years of age. And then in pediatrics, in public health, in pediatrics, public health care, it's up to 16 years.
I'm 2 years old.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sometimes it's there's genetics, like often when it's that young, there'll be genetic drivers. Like literally, there could be a melanocortin receptor dysfunction, something's
Yeah.
gone, like, actual genes. And then sometimes we can pick it up quite early because there'll be other very obvious signs, like for example with melanocortin. Like this is getting quite a neurobiology, but it's that's how
Yeah.
important it is. That's important to all these different things that people don't understand, that might just look at someone and go make assumptions about that child and about the parents and the parenting, and they have
Yeah.
no idea that actually there might be nothing that they can do. So it could be just a gene defect, and that's no one's fault. No one's fault, and that can be driving it,
Yeah.
which many people do not understand.
But they don't, and I, as I said it earlier on, I wasn't fully aware of it either when it came to myself and other things. Last question from me, because I think we've got through an awful lot. Boys and girls, do you ever find any difference in them? I suppose as they're getting older, you said you had up until age 16, you see, is it? So do you ever not like would there be would there be a difference in the way they approach it, the way they handle it, the way their experiences, presumed there probably will be.
Absolutely. There's differences between younger children and older children and teenagers. What's very obvious, is younger children, the body image concerns they become increasingly aware of that as they're getting older. And that's linked in with stages of development as well. And when they hit puberty and they start becoming more aware of themselves because their body is changing and it's actually changing out of their control. They've got the hormones kick in. Don't
Yeah.
know if you've got the lovely breed of teenagers yourself yet.
No, not
Yeah,
yet.
yet to experience that adventure.
Great. Looking forward to it.
But the hormones kick in and sometimes they can't explain things, or they can't explain, and they don't want things to happen. They might want these changes to happen, or they are becoming a lot more aware of their bodies and these changes. That's outside of their control. And so you do notice a big difference in their awareness. But also you'll still see it in younger children, especially where it's being pointed out to them by others. A common one is children not being picked for in PE to be on someone's team, or not being picked
Yeah.
until last because they're deemed maybe not as good because of their body weight and shape,
Yeah.
their body shape and size. So these, there's instances like this, or sometimes again can be things that are said to them. Like they do pick on things, and the more happens, the more like it's an accumulation effect. The more they'll start to realize, oh, wait a minute, that's the second person that said that to me, or that's now, like the 10th time that I haven't been picked. This is really horrible. This is really nasty. I don't like being left to last to be picked to be
Yeah.
on the team. I'm actually better at kicking the ball, or I'm actually better at dancing. I'm actually more flexible. I can do the splits. Why would they not want me on their
Yeah.
gymnastics team or in their dance group or whatever it is?
It's
Why?
heartbreaking. Yeah, it is. It's heartbreaking.
And what
We've
we can do, sorry, Keith, I
No,
just
I was
mentioned.
gonna that's
There's
okay.
parents thinking. There's parents thinking about this and going, "Oh my gosh, I don't want my child to experience that. That's awful." It's
Yeah.
trying to build up their self-esteem from a very. You can always keep on continuing to build it and not relating it to their body shape or size. It's building up them and their how they value themselves, and remembering that there's so much, and trying to help build their resilience as well. It's so hard because we can't control how other people around us act. We can't control their behaviors or their attitudes. Like that's why I do this kind of thing.
I was just going to say that the
It's
more
to help.
conversations and the more speaking out and awareness you can bring to it, the better, I suppose, because it is just about education and understanding, isn't it?
But even the language in the home as well. Like that's another
Yeah.
thing. If you are a parent, if you're a grandparent, because grandparents do a lot of care after school or, weekends or whatever, just be conscious, especially, as I said, especially the kind of older generations who this will be very nuanced to hear. What? Do we not do that? Why wouldn't we? So what's the harm? This is the harm. There is so much. I hope this conversation has been enlightening as to how much harm it can cause. So saying things like, you know, oh, finish your plate. The children in Africa, or the people in Africa are starving. Well, I can tell you, I've lived in Uganda. I've lived in extreme poverty over there. And finishing our plates here in Ireland doesn't make a bit of a difference over there. It's not as if the food gets scooped up and sent over. You know, these kind of like encourage intuitive eating, encourage those feelings of fullness and hunger. And this doesn't happen for all children. We see that a lot in our service, that some children don't experience hunger. And the way I try and explain it to parents, because it can be really hard, you're like, how are they hungry? Like they're constantly hungry. They've just had their food. They just had their dinner. And they're wanting something half an hour later. And it's like, but you don't know if they are hungry or not, because you can't feel what it's like to be inside their body. You can't look at me and go, geez, Niamh, you're starving. You know, you might say, gosh, are you hungry, or are you just snappy, or are you just hormonal? But you don't know that I'm actually hungry. You can't say that about another individual, because it's an in-body experience. And some children and some adults as well do not have the same experiences of hunger and fullness as others. So we need to be really careful about that. As role models, our language around, again, going back to just not commenting on people's body shapes and sizes, or not relating it to success.
Good point.
You know, because someone is, whatever, really successful in sports or in their career or in their whatever it is, it's because of so many different things. It's because of their abilities, their talents, maybe their personality, maybe because they worked really hard, you know. And that's, again, comes back to building up self-esteem, building up confidence, focusing on all the things that one is good at, and that makes one feel happy. If we can embrace that more, rather than focusing on and comparing as well. Avoid comparing.
Yeah, which is something we've all done, even to ourselves, over the years. So I think that it doesn't matter what age you are. I think you'll always be a little bit susceptible. Just can even say the word. You'll always be a bit susceptible to doing that, you know.
Yeah, but I mean other people comparing.
Oh,
so
sorry,
I mean,
right,
like grandparents comparing siblings.
Gotcha. Right.
And going, how is your brother like that? And
right.
Like this, or whatever it is, or cousins is another one that often happens. Like avoid that comparison thing. It doesn't help at all.
No.
Embrace what that individual person is good at, focusing on those positives. And I think, again, maybe it's an Irish, it's our cultural thing that, you know, I often think of the generations and not wanting to, you don't want to be having any notions now. No notions. Don't be having notions about yourself. You know, that kind of way. And it's like, but I am good at this, or I have done that well. Am I not entitled to say that? You know, to embrace
that's an Irish thing as well, isn't it? Sometimes.
Yeah. Sure, she has notions. Everyone has notions.
Right. Go take your notions elsewhere. I think we've probably covered just about everything. Niamh Arthurs, geez, it still sounds surreal even saying that. Niamh Arthurs, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. So
you're very welcome. I have to say, listening to you talk, you're extremely passionate about this, which is amazing to see. Like, you can't hide that you're extremely passionate about this, which, like I said, is amazing. And it's been, I actually think it's been probably one of the most educational episodes I've done, and I've never covered obesity in an episode before, at least not in a full episode anyway. So I actually think this is really important what you're doing, and I think it's amazing. Because, like I said, like myself, right? So I don't see a lot of people talking about body dysmorphia. I don't see a lot of people talking about obesity in a kind of a clinical and medical sense. Do you do as well, as obviously about the person and taking a holistic approach to the actual person? So I actually say thanks for doing that, and yeah, it's been amazing.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. I usually at the end say, do you want to give your socials a shout out, Anne? But there's no point in you doing it. Do you help that?
I'm not even on them. I'm not even telling my mom and dad.
I was just going to say, we can give their Instagram if you like. I don't care.
Yeah. But like this, you know, this is voluntary. I work full time clinically, and then all this kind of stuff is voluntary in my own time, you know. So I'm not promoting anything individual to me here. I want just people to understand more. I want people to be informed, and I want people to know where to go to find out more, to be more educated. And I believe that if we keep doing this and we keep targeting different platforms and reaching different audiences who have never thought about this before, like even yourself there, that's really, you know, insightful to hear. It's made worth my time being here that at least one person has heard and now understands differently. That 5 hour flight, to tell you, no one's ever going to want to sit beside
I
me in a
was going
flight
to say that.
with me. But you know, it's the little by little. I use every opportunity I can to help people understand, because it's so unfair. It's so unfair, and there's so little I can do in when the child, a teenager, opens up to me, which I really, really appreciate, you know, that they feel safe enough to do that. And it's horrible that those experiences have happened. I wish they didn't happen. I wish they didn't happen in the first place, and that they didn't cause all these effects and the downwards and the spiral of things, that if people understood more, they wouldn't have to be there, and they wouldn't have to have that really hard time. That's what really, really, yeah, that's what I want to see happening. I want to see that change.
Yeah, me too. I agree. Totally agree. Amazing, Niamh. Thank you so much. Let's leave it there. Off you go with your notions.
Go join
You
Instagram now.
that. You do that. Right, guys. Yep, amazing. Love that. I'll be back again very soon with another episode of the Endless Aspire podcast. Thanks again, Niamh. Brilliant.